Galactic Holonet. Welcome to the Captain's Quarters, where your captain, Richard White, better known as Kelvin Tiberius, talks about whatever the hell he feels like. Today, on the podcast, we're talking about RPGs. Now, if you were expecting X-Wing, for the love of God, I'm sorry, delete this podcast. But if you want to listen to RPGs, let's go ahead and talk about them. Joining me today is Matt Newt. What's up, Matt? My conciliary, actually.
Indeed. How are we doing out there, Holonet?
So, Matt, this is actually all your fault. Because you said to tell me what you said to me about doing this.
Since you've been somewhat busy the last couple podcasts, it seems that the crew and the B team have taken over the boiler room, and I just may have mentioned that this mutiny should not stand, and that maybe the captain needs to take back control of the ship, sort of little authority here.
You told me that I should upload the podcast and not tell Blair, which is exactly what I'm doing. So, Blair, if you're listening, this is for you. Anyways, also joining me today is my buddy Joe Concha. What's up, Joe?
Hey, how's it going, everybody?
Yeah, man. I'm excited to talk RPGs with you, Joe and I. Matt and I have played RPGs, obviously, on the podcast Patreon RPG. And Matt runs a Star Wars game for me. Joe and I have been gaming. Joe, how long have we been gaming?
Since 2010, I think.
Do you actually know that? Like, I actually don't know. I was just going to guess a number.
That's a good guy. I mean, if you guess accurately and professionally enough, people believe you.
That's a good point. So yes, until 2010, I remember. So yeah, yes. We've been playing a whole bunch of games before. And so we're kind of familiar with this subject. Obviously we've spent countless hours talking about RPGs and various states of sobriety. And then finally, the whole reason for this is Ryan Farmer's joining us today. What's up, Ryan?
Hey, how's it going, man?
You and I have been talking about getting on either one of our podcasts to talk RPGs for maybe at least a year.
Yeah.
I feel like this has been an ongoing discussion that we've had and that hasn't actually happened. So now it is today. Anyways, then you and I talk RPGs offline pretty often.
Yeah,
so.
Fairly regularly, I'd say. More often than I think either of us realize.
Yeah. So for me, as much as I love X-Wing, my real love for gaming is actually RPGs. I don't know if you guys all share that as like that's your number one or if it's up there anyways, but I kind of want to jump into this. Let's kind of talk about, how we got into RPGs, what we love about them and that sort of thing. But just because this is the RPG episode, I do want to kind of pick the order of how we go through this by rolling initiative. So go ahead, and if you have a D20, get it out and roll it. If not, I know that you've got access to an online dice roller. I know every single one of you do because I know you bastards too well. Or you have a D20 next to you. So go ahead and roll me a D20 and tell me what you roll.
I rolled a natural 20.
I also rolled a natural 20.
No, you didn't.
Which one of you bastards has a higher dexterity, has a higher initiative mod?
It definitely isn't me.
It's probably me.
Hold up. To be fair, Ryan announced it first, so he clearly has the higher initiative mod.
There you go.
I'm sending you a screenshot of it in our Facebook chat just so you can see.
I'm going to send a Facebook chat shot of definitely my 20 once I am able to find it. I swear.
With my dexterity modifier, I believe I have a 0.
Okay. Nice.
Whoa. Well,
all right. So
minus 1 is 0.
So, Farmer, tell me about how you got into RPGs and why you kind of love them.
All right. Well, I didn't actually play
why
my.
You do love them.
Yeah, I do love them. Yeah. I didn't actually get to play my first pen and paper RPG until college. Mm-hmm. When I was a kid, I did do like, I guess the thing that kids do where they play pretend. It's not LARPing yet because you're still young. I don't think it's considered LARPing until after you hit puberty, I guess. But we always would like play games, pick up sticks, that sort of thing. And my friends always used to make fun of me because one of my things I used to say a lot was, all right, guys, let's get serious, because I always liked the more serious tones of the games when we actually like did serious things and fought quote-unquote real monsters. But
yeah, Cowboys and Indians was not like just a game. Like,
no,
you wanted to like understand what the Cowboys' motivations were.
I wanted blood. yeah, but
possibly treasure.
Impossible, maybe treasure. I wanted to when I played video games. I played the Final Fantasy games, and that was great. But it wasn't until college when somebody was playing. I finally got a group together that was playing 4th edition, and
D&D.
Yeah, D&D, 4th edition.
Have I talked to you about 4th edition D&D?
We've talked. I know it's your favorite.
I'm one of the dozen.
Slightly fond of it.
I'm one of the dozens left. There are dozens of us, who prefer 4th edition.
4th edition, honestly, so it was my first run, and my first DMing experience was on 4th edition. I created an anti-paladin as my first character, and that was really, really awesome. And for me, I guess what I love the most about RPing is that you can do things and make experiences that you can't get anywhere else. And I think that nowhere else can you have the depth of story or creativity than you can with a bunch of friends around a table making shit up.
Yeah. Some about RPGs when there is that extra layer of investment because it's your story and you have stakes. Even if they're completely tropey stakes, which I'll talk to like at length about how tropes are great in RPGs because they're tropes for a reason. But like you have investment in it, like sort of like I love that.
Yeah, and I guess I'll just close out by saying that the memories you create. I think anybody that's ever knocked D&D, and it has gone through a little bit of a renaissance right now. It's become much.
Oh yeah, it's super popular now.
Yeah,
right?
It's becoming much less like shunned and like, oh, you're a geek or a social outcast if you play. I think that lots of like celebrities have come out and said that they play. It's become less like you don't want to hide that you played anymore, which I think is great. But anybody that doesn't like it, I don't think has ever played it because or had. Not an ideal group to play with. And the reason I say that is because it's such an amazing social experience with people and you create such phenomenal memories.
It is inherently a weird one too, right? Like it is like, I don't think you can beat around the bush that like sitting around at a table with dice pretending shit is not inherently kind of weird, like in a good weird,
but
outside your box weird, but it's weird, right?
That's the thing though. I think that it obviously it's a lot of work for whoever your GM is, but if you can get a good group, like some people don't like fantasy, I get that. Some people aren't into orcs and elves and dwarves, but RPing and tabletop games specifically aren't restricted to just fantasy. That's just kind of what Dungeons and Dragons kind of has the hold over.
Yeah.
You can do sci-fi. I've been wanting to do one with my buddy D where everyone is a sleeper agent and like a code word wakes everyone up and they're like working for the CIA as spies. Like, there's a whole bunch of different ways to do it that if you have a group of friends that like all the same thing, you can tailor an RP for basically anything.
Yeah, exactly. All right, so let's kind of move on because we're just going to take over the whole thing.
No, I'm good. I'm done. Continue.
Yosef, so tell me about like what got you into role-playing games and why you kind of love it. Why you love it. Jeez, I'm terrible today.
That's all right. I'm already just proud of myself that I can keep my mouth shut. this is not like me. So I got into it when I was very young. Same thing, Final Fantasy, video games. I was raised on movies and video games. It was my favorite thing in the world. And I loved seeing heroic characters doing heroic things and saying cool stuff. I mean, there's all these great dramatic moments from old classic video games. And my dad played D&D when he was younger in college. And so we got my brother and I and a couple of our friends together to play it when I think, geez, we were in middle school, maybe even.
I gotta be honest with you. I'm extremely jealous that your brother played with you because I didn't have that. And I think that would just be so cool.
It was very cool. And he liked GMing a lot, which is
great.
Oh yeah, no, it made my life. That's why I'm a professional player now. In more ways than one. He would run the games after my dad decided to kind of step back and just leave us to be kids and teenagers and whatever we were going to do. And it was always a blast. It was a way to bond. It was a way to be closer to people and to do something when you were sitting around a table. And then it wasn't like a game where you had to finish the game. It stopped whenever everybody said, okay, hey, let's take a break and get lunch, you know, or whatever. It had its own cadence that felt natural to a group that was already friends. And I think that's a way to bring people together from different walks of life and from different backgrounds and say, hey, it's okay. We can find a rhythm that's fun for everyone.
Mm-hmm.
My first character was an elf thief, because I've always been about having all the answers to all the problems. And I try very hard not to do that anymore, but I've played a huge variety of styles. I played through high school, and then I played a whole ton of different things in undergrad. And then in grad school, I met you, Ricky, and we started hanging out. It was a great time, and I just always look for more ways to play the game, because you can always bring something new to the table and learn something about yourself and your friends.
Yeah, it's funny. You learn a lot about somebody when playing role-playing games with them. I know it sounds ridiculous, but it's absolutely true. Like, you learn what's important to them. Like, no joke, I'm not going to tangent too hard on this, but you remember Paul Wilson was a buddy of me and Joe's, super specific. Oh my God. Terrible example. But this guy was a super hardcore libertarian, right? And was all about individual agency and stuff like that. And a buddy of ours wanted to start a union in this game. And he flipped out and got really angry about it. And it was really interesting to see no man, you can't take that person's liberty, blah, blah, blah. He got really into it. And it was just really kind of interesting, to kind of see that about him. So you do learn stuff about people.
Well, and you also learn who to avoid, because the guy who was needling him about it just ate it up and got worse. He's a professional troll if he's listening.
Yeah.
Names won't be named.
Yeah. He's a Cylon. Anyways.
He's always a Cylon.
So I don't know. I think that it's kind of fun to you find out stuff about people. I'll get into mine, since I roll better than a zero initiative.
Nice.
I got into RPGs when I think I may have told this before, but I got into RPGs when I was ballpark 12 years old. A buddy of mine in Boy Scouts, who was a little bit older than us, I think he was in high school, and we were in the end of grade school. And he was into RPGs, and he offered to run me and my buddy Scott, who were huge Star Wars fans. He offered to, he's like, hey, let me show you this, this thing. It's called a role-playing game. You know, you can be a Star Wars character, you can do stuff. And Scott and I were absolutely bought in. We're in, that sounds awesome. You know, I made a GAN smuggler or something like that. I can't even remember. And we played, and it was just awesome. The funniest thing about that, though, was it was going over to my buddy's house. It was an overnight stay, and we're all playing RPGs and stuff. And there are some older kids playing with us. And I swear to God, within about 30 minutes of us starting this game, these two guys decide to kill me and my buddy's character. Right. And that's my introduction to RPGs. It turned into a 2-hour long fight. And this is my first session. And I remember it being such a big deal. And I thought it was hilarious. And then, we ended up doing it again, and it being fine later. But still, that was my first game. Anyways, I've been playing basically since I was 12, and you can calculate that's something 20 plus years of RPGs. And for me, I really to your point, Joe, I I think it's really entertaining to see what people come up with and what you can come up with them. And there's something about that that I find incredibly fascinating, and in a way that you don't get with other sort of creative things. Closest thing I've come to it would be even podcasting. It's not even the same. Anyway, so that's kind of me. Matt, what got you into role-playing, and what do you like about it?
Oh, coming from a bit of an earlier generation, I got into RPGs around 11 and 12 as well, only this was in the 80s in the middle of the big satanic panic.
Right. So if you're playing D&D, you're worshiping the devil.
Yeah, and everything's in black and white. Oh, wait.
Yeah. You know, so I.
Nice.
Peppers. I had been exposed to D&D, seeing a couple older teenagers playing at summer camp, and I thought, this is pretty awesome. So when I came back home, I asked my mom, "Mom, can we buy some Dungeons & Dragons I want to play?" Oh, that went over like a fart in church. After I had to go talk to our pastor and get explained to why this was such a terrible thing, we're out, and my mom, one of the few things I could do was read comic books, mm-hmm. and I saw what I thought was a boxed comic book set, and it turned out to be the original Marvel Superheroes RPG basic set.
Nice.
Came with a pair of D10s because it's a percentile based system. My mother had no idea this was the same type of role playing game, even put out by TSR, the people who make Dungeons and Dragons. It even said on the back of the box, "From the people who brought you Dungeons and Dragons." My mother never read the back of the box.
It's not evil if you don't know about it.
Exactly. So that was my introduction to role-playing, because it was almost like a gateway straight from reading comics into suddenly now you have the mechanism to tell your own stories. Mm-hmm. And so I started out, my younger brother and I, and then a couple months later, I get at the comic book store, saw Champions, the superhero RPG. And this was actually my first foray into, let me create something original. And that ended up just snowballing from Champions into, then I got into high school and Shadowrun and GURPS and AD&D. And then I got lucky enough when in my early 20s, I lived out in Northern Virginia, and our local mall had a Wizards of the Coast store, an actual brick and mortar Wizards of the Coast
store.
Wow.
Awesome.
Yeah.
That's a unicorn. And hey, I'm going to go play some magic here. And we go in and they say, "Oh, are you here for third edition?" I said, "Third edition of what?" They said, "Oh, Dungeons & Dragons third edition is coming out this weekend." I said, "I'll take it." And pretty much had been gaming with, you know, roommates and friends. And I have been a GM probably about a 8-to-1 ratio versus being a player over the last 30 years. And the things I love most about role-playing games is it hits two of what I think are the fundamental social aspects of people. You have a game, and that is one of those things where you get people together, and it's not competitive like a game of, say, X-Wing. Mm-hmm. It's almost like what I like to call cooperative antagonism. You have a player and a GM or a referee who's establishing the rules of this world. You're not competing against each other, but there's give and take to it, like improv acting, but with an element of randomness in there. And the other part of it is a shared narrative. I've always loved telling stories and getting to lay out a skeleton and watch what other people do to fill that in is one of the greatest feelings, because I don't know how many times I will have planned out, okay, I've got routes A through F planned for whatever my players do. I will put the first detail out there and they immediately go straight to Q.
I'm going to take credit for that stuff.
Problem that child who does that regularly.
That doesn't sound like you at all.
That's my favorite thing in the world. What's this? I'm going to do this thing. Get ready for that.
For about the past 6 months, every single gaming session I have designed has a sub, like a footer going, "In case of Ricky."
I consider that a mark of pride, man.
I'm already learning things about running games. Have a Ricky plan.
yeah, your option was to just murder me.
Well, hey, it worked pretty well, right?
All right. So I did actually want to get into that, just to kind of give an idea. I know actually all of us are actually running a game right now.
We're
all GMs, and I kind of want to, like, look, I'm going to be honest, like, I think we're all fully aware that you can only listen to someone else talk about their campaign for about 2 minutes before you go, "Okay, man, I don't care anymore," just because that's a real thing. So let's not go too deep into this, because I know that we all could potentially be guilty of it, but let's not kind of talk about what we're running. And just to kind of show off the sort of insane, like, differences in stories you can tell and how you can tell them. So tell me what you're running on what system, and I don't know how it's going. I don't know. I guess I can start. I'm doing the SMV game right now. We're on currently on hiatus, which isn't going well, but it's a Star Wars game. We run FFG Star Wars, and I think I've shown everybody parts of this. Matt's obviously in it, but we're doing a sandbox game where you can just go to like basically things are happening amongst the planets, and the players go and they choose to interact with that situation. Those sort of like quest trees sort of change as I run it, and that's kind of been really fun to run for me because I don't like to know what's going to happen in the grand scheme of things. I might throw an adventure in for you know the next couple of sessions, but in the end, I don't actually know what the real story is going to be until we do it. So that's kind of one of my favorite things about running, you know, at least my game. I don't know who to go next. So let's see. It's been a minute since I heard from Farmer. Like, I think that your game that you're running is super interesting, and I kind of want you to talk about the system that you're running it too.
Yeah. So I mentioned him earlier. My buddy D Yoon has a custom system he's creating that we've been playtesting for a few years, and it's personally my favorite system I've ever used for any RPG ever. Unfortunately, he's I guess not unfortunately, but I'm NDA'd on it, so I can't talk a ton of specifics. But I can say instead of a D20, he uses 4D6, which he likes a lot better because when you do a D20 type system, it's it's a 5% for any result. For 4D6.
When are you gonna let me play test that? You gotta like poke D.
You gotta talk to D for sure. He's still trying to write it up. A lot of it's just in his head. But when you do 4D6, a crit fail is if you do a roll 4 through a 7, and a crit success is a 21 through 24. And on that bell curve, it's so much rarer for you to get a fail or a success like that. And it's just out of this world when it actually does happen. So I'm GMing a story for that, and what I'm doing is I'm a big Revolutionary War fan, so, and I'm a fantasy fan. So what we're doing is they're all in 1774 Boston right before the Revolution, and they're all supernatural monster hunters. So like there are, but no one even knows they exist except for like them and a few very specific other people. And so there are like, basically, kind of the hook that I'm working on right now is it's really this underground cult of vampires that are spurring the revolutionaries in order to cause war so that they can get blood. So that's the kind of what I'm working with at the moment. And they just had a bonkers session last night. We have a summoner, and he accidentally rolled a 20. Well, whenever he summons, it's basically a grab bag. He summons something random and he has to try to control it. Well, he rolled a 23 on his summon, so he just summoned the Greek god Helios, who was trapped in hell, and that's now a major story point. And that's as much that's as much as I'll say about it right now. But it's a really, really fun campaign that I'm running. It's something way different because usually I've stuck with like high fantasy or high, like really high sci-fi. It's cool to have something grounded in a little more reality. So that's what I'm on, and I love it a lot.
I want to ask you, like, just because I'm curious, because I'm definitely interested to just see to be a fly on the wall on that. Like, how tropey are those sessions? Like, are we talking, you're playing it serious, like, and these guys are like actual vampire hunters, or are these guys, you know, smoking cigarettes and tossing into like flame stuff and like making explosions and whatnot?
It's really interesting. It really depends on how they play. It can get tropey and it can get not tropey. A lot of that stuff it is determined by the dice rolls. Like D's character is supposed to be this storyteller and this lore master, and he critically failed to identify that a vampire had like come to them, like like walked up to their house, and he didn't even know what a vampire was. Like it can get tropey, but it all stays super grounded. And I try to like have I work in film in my real person life, and so I like to incorporate like cinematic moments, But that's only if the characters decide to take those moments or to work with them. And a lot of times, the dice create those moments. Like, like yesterday when they were cornered by 8 vampire thralls, and that's when the summoner rolled a desperation roll, and that's when the crit happened, and Helios comes and saves all of them. That was super cinematic and super unplanned.
Yeah, that's one of my favorite things about RPGs is sort of when something just comes out of nowhere and you discover something about the story, right? I never like it when I always tell people that the story about your game isn't what you wrote before the game. It was what happened after you talked about the game.
Absolutely.
Or certainly. Anyways, so something that you mentioned, I know that you work in film, and I know you're a theater kid, right?
No, I never did theater, but I was a jock specifically, which is weird.
Oh, no.
But I went
to Daywalker. You were like a Daywalker of nerds.
How did you get into the? How did you get into AV then?
There wasn't theater. I did broadcasting. My video background was editing highlight films for the other athletes and shooting sporting events and stuff. And then on the side, I made like Star Wars short films because those were cool.
I was going to say, because I found like there's a ton of theater kids that got into D&D and RPGs in general. I mean, I know, Joe, that might not be what you're a theater kid, even though more from the tech side. But I mean, yeah, I know so many like theater people. I don't know, Matt, if you got that background. I don't, but this is something that I found.
My theater background was all creative writing and the things, though.
All right, so
I do think though that it lends itself well, any kind of storytelling or any kind of urge to be creative, you know, to get it out of you. Like, this is a perfect venue for it. I put D&D and RPGs and stuff in the exact same category as theater or even film. You know, it's the same kind of deal, only your audience is just a different size and the rules are different.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I like no doubt about it. Like from my end, I did improv in college for a little while, and that's where the kind of that came in, and that was just to accentuate film stuff or whatever. But it is great when I think my favorite thing about RPGs is when everyone decides just to buy in. Not everyone has to like do accents or act or whatever, but just buying in and really getting invested in the game and not feeling weird. That's what I like the most.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So I've got a little sidetracked. I'm going to talk about everybody's games that they're running, just kind of go through that stuff. I want to go to Matt. Newt, what are you running right now? I guess you could pick one.
I also happen to have a Star Wars game that's on hiatus because...
we're both in shame.
Hey, it's brand recognition.
Yeah.
I've got a decent reason because I was selected as a playtester for Evil Hat's new Fate of Cthulhu system.
Nice.
And I'm running that. Ricky is actually one of my players along with 3 of our friends.
Mm-hmm.
Anybody's used the Fate system before? It's an incredible narrative-driven system that avoids statistics and no stat numbers, no attributes in favor of aspects. And everything is based on... can you make it narratively interesting? And that's one of the things I love about the system mechanically, is that if something is narratively interesting, you can go ahead and try for it. I have always loved horror as a genre, and I tend to find a way to work that into whatever I'm doing. Not necessarily an all-out horror like D&D. I ironically hated Ravenloft, but I loved the tropes that come with horror storytelling are players fear the unknown. Just like in any good horror movie, you fear the villain up until the point where you see them. The fun bits are when what I love is laying these clues out there, and the first time the players realize what's going on, that moment of, oh, passes around the table. That's an amazing feeling. In the Cthulhu game, to give a bit of the
I will say something about Fate. Like, one thing I will say about Fate is that is the thing that Joe and I, who are, I think we get to the same conclusion from completely separate RPG ways, but we agree that Fate is like the best game.
Oh, I was going to chime in and say, you know, Fate is my favorite system in the world. When I first played it, I absolutely despised it. I thought, where's the dice? I'm down to 4 dice here. I got no stats. I got nothing going on. And then I realized, oh wait, I have all this power now because I'm freed of the gritty technical elements of a system. And that just exactly. it totally opened up my eyes, you know. And
there is still a mechanical system. It's just you have to play it differently. It's about, you know, setting up advantages and then collectively using those advantages. So, but you have to set up those advantages in a creative way.
Well, sure. But you can build on top of that system so quickly, a whole nother system for playing the game. I mean, the examples alone that they give in the books about fighting a fire in a house and stuff are incredible, but you can go a step further and game that system into almost a totally different system built on top of it.
I think we do need to mention flying and biting.
Yeah. That's the quickest way to. It's the quickest system to make up characters ever, or minions, right? You have flying sharks, and flying sharks have +2 flying and biting, and they have -2 anything that isn't flying and biting. I'm just saying, it's the elegance. The elegance of that statement is mind blowing to me.
The document has a
the character fire has a +2 skill in burning.
-2 in not burning.
Right. So
fire.
The hilarious things that came out of the Fate of Cthulhu playtest is that the anybody who was Shoggoth possessed in one adventure had the aspect of Squamous.
I don't know what that is.
Precisely. It's a word that comes up a lot in Lovecraftian stuff. It just means having a appearance, bulbous tumorous, that type of thing. A squamous mass is often how some of the Cthulhoid entities are described. And it's just their aspect is squamous. Whatever you choose that word to mean is fine. So the thing I love about that kind of storytelling, coincidentally, about 6 months prior, last September, Joe had actually been in town, and we were all sitting down to play at my place, and they requested a Fate game, and I started them out in a Western game. Everybody had their cowpoke characters, and it was wonderful, and about 2 hours into the game, they run into the sheriff, who is a cultist of Dagon, and I believe at this point, two of the players immediately stood up, paced around the table, and said, "We are not geared for Cthulhu, holy shit," and again, that moment of realization when multiple people realize what's going on, that right there is the part I love about running a game. It's getting everybody invested.
I do want you to talk about the structure of this playtest campaign, just because it's very, very cool in how there. I think you've got like a couple of set. You've got several set pieces, but you have the ability to just kind of, you just got to get to those set pieces and you can kind of pick when they happen, right?
Without going into the NDA details, okay. The elevator pitch for it is
all you guys in your NDAs
of your Cthulhu type stories. It's set in a gothic university or some far off Castle Rock, Maine type thing. This is based more off of Terminator. Mm-hmm. Because the opening pitch is, it is 2030, the end of the world is happening, and you have to get sent back in time to stop it. So it's time travel is a major mechanic in this playtest, where the players originally appeared in 1966 and have to change 4 pivotal events in time going the long way around. They jumped back. They can't jump forward.
It's pretty awesome.
It is. But when you think about it from a GM's perspective, we got to pick. Okay, so we got to kind of like choose what order, like we wanted to go to, like what thing we wanted to try and stop, and that determined the order in which they happen. I don't know that for sure, but it kind of seems that way.
And that's more just a narrative storytelling thing. Mm-hmm. I believe it's a fun thing. Fate encourages this. A lot of other systems encourage this. Giving the players agency to help build the world. When they had these 4 events that they knew of, they jump back in time, and I asked the players, all right, historically, what order did these things happen in? and they talk amongst themselves, put that in. And I said, all right, that is the order of your next four sessions. This is how we're going to do this.
So what I like about that design is so here's the thing. We chose that history and we sort of made it. And in making it, something that Ryan said he always likes is buy in. We bought into that history and we bought into the story, and that is something that doesn't even matter as far as running. Like, mm-hmm. Who cares what order it happens in, really? I mean, you could do it in any order just because it's just like running an adventure from a book. Like, you know, like you've got your set pieces, you run it, but the order in which they happen got buy-in from us, and now we want to play. I don't know. I think that portion of it is like a subtle like thing that helps engagement. I really like
that. That's one of the most useful DM tips out there. When you ask your players, even little things like, hey, what's the name of this bar?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it gives them a chance to play into it and own the part of the story that's them too. I mean, more than their characters even. Mm-hmm. You get to contribute to it. And as a person who strongly dislikes contributing a lot of the time, being able to selectively chime in with, oh, I was thinking this thing would be really cool, you know, when my turn comes around is great.
I think, I totally agree with on that. I think that as a GM, whenever you can allow your players to have a major hand in crafting your world or influencing how it's built, there are tons and tons of great guides on how to be a great GM. There are tons of great GMs online. I'm a big Critical Role fan, but one thing you'll see over and over is you're really just building the foundation and the kind of the exterior skeleton of a house, and your players and the dice and the events that are happening are really fleshing the rest out. And mm-hmm. asking the player what the name of that bar is great. Or even if a player mentions later, like, yeah, when I was, you know, my favorite bar when I was traveling through blah, blah, blah was the, you know, the Thirsty Wicket. I don't know. That was a really bad name. the Cow's Udder. I don't know. Then
Hold up.
Hold on. Everybody has a default name. Everybody has a name they start with, though.
Yeah, exactly. And all you do is, like, you take that and you write it down somewhere, and later on you can bring that up, and your players will appreciate it when they feel they've contributed in that way.
Yeah, another cool plug for Fate is you can even make an aspect of that bar.
Yeah.
Oh, no, it's that place.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, and there are certain things that are true at that place, and those are the aspects that you can invoke.
The old Cow's Udder. That's right.
Mm-hmm. All right. So Matt mentioned, you know, what's the name of that bar, which I think is good a transition for Joe. What game are you running right now?
So I'm running a Savage Worlds campaign, more specifically in the Deadlands universe, which is, they call it the Weird West, but it's kind of Western mixed with occult. And we are only one session in. Actually, Matt and Ricky are both playing in that game too. They make up half my player base. We got five players so far, all friends from home there. And
And he runs from Pittsburgh on Roll20.
Yeah. But I'm running totally remote, and I've been playing remote for about 4 or 5 years now because mm-hmm. work takes me everywhere. Mm-hmm. So we're only about a session in, and typically I get prepared with understanding a contextual arc of what I want the feel to be at each beat of not just the session but the game. You know, I like to understand what kind of things I'm working with as far as story elements to say, okay, this piece is going to start pulling, this piece is going to start pulling. And then that gives context to all of my characters as well. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And allows people to react to the world in that sense. And it keeps the game moving too. Cause if I mirror it on an episode of a show, right. Or a movie or a scene that I really like, people will key in on that rhythm as well and add into it.
Yeah, I love your Deadlands game. Other than a full disclosure, I am full incapacitated right now, so I am like super sad about that.
But you knew the job was dangerous when you took it, and that's part of knowing your system too.
Deadlands is so deadly. It's such a cool universe, though. Westerns, I love westerns.
I'd still love to try it in the Fate system, to be honest. I think you could get a little crazier with some of the things you could do. But as a system, I do like the brutality of it. And that's one of the reasons that I like the Legend of the Five Rings system a lot too, which is not one you come across very often. It's, you know, mystic Far East Japan kind of setting. Same kind of deal. It's a tighter role-playing restriction, but this is just as brutal. Somebody hits you with a sword and it feels like getting hit with a sword, just like in Deadlands. Getting shot feels like getting shot.
Yeah. Oh God, it's so brutal.
On that note, actually, Joe, have you seen anything with the new Fantasy Flight Games Five Rings RPG system?
I haven't. I've seen that it exists. I have not gotten a chance to look into it. I think I played the fourth edition was what we were on when I played in 2015, 2014. So. Mm-hmm.
They revealed of it. It looks really interesting. Again, like most FFG games, that kind of high learning curve, but once you get into it, it looks really elegant. I'm actually kind of hyped for that.
Yeah, there's a lot of backstory to it as well. That understanding that world it goes further into regimented world building than I typically like to go. But that's why I like to leverage cool things about, like, take what's useful. I mean, there's a Bruce Lee quote of absorb what is useful, disregard what is useless, and make what is essential your own. So I like to take things from the Deadlands book or from the Legend of the Five Rings book and say, that's a really cool thing. And then a lot of times, thematically, it'll work in multiple settings. You know, you can take a piece from here and a piece from there. And it that makes for those great curveballs like that game you ran.
Yeah, man.
wait, she's possessed? What?
No. All right, so yeah, you all have now have a mental health stress tracker. No, sanity stress track.
Yeah.
You know, like Joe and I are drunk off our asses and it's 3 hours in after we've been drinking for our convention when Joe's in town, and we're told that we have a stress check track and we have to deal with that. And we're like, we're not mentally prepared for this, man. Anyways, I want to go into another subject here on, since we are all GMs, and I just kind of want to, like, I'm just curious, kind of like how people differ, and what is your all's prep like when you make your game? Like, what are you doing to, how long does it take you to kind of come up with stuff? Farmer, what do you do to prep your games?
Nothing really. really, I envy you.
I don't know how you guys do that.
I live on the improvisation. Well, the one thing is I can't.
Okay, so my counter to that is if you're not doing anything for a game session, what did you do to get to that point where you were okay doing that?
Well, the unique thing is for, like, it's hard to prep for doing D stuff because he doesn't have anything really written down. So it's not like I can prep monster stats with a monster manual or that sort of thing. I do have a notebook where I'll kind of bare bones my idea of what where I'm going to start, I guess, like what's going to happen. And then for some monsters, I'll write down certain attributes that I feel will be important for that. But, you know, so many times when you prep and you prep and you prep and you prep, it all just goes to crap on when they choose to do something else. You waste so much time. And so the most I'll do is rough map layouts for various locations that they could be or could fight or battle or whatever, and some ideas of how some hooks could go. On the other hand, I prep a lot for the one-shots that I do. Yeah. I've run one shots pretty, like, when I can, because I have some friends that I only get to see once a month. So I've done an Avatar: The Last Airbender one shot. I have a classical.
Did I show you my Viking one?
Yes, that's amazing. I want to do that one. I just haven't gotten to it.
We ran that the other day. It was pretty awesome.
Awesome, dude. That's so good.
Yeah, that'd be great.
And I have a classic, like, Necromancer Tower one. And all of those, the reason I prep a lot for those is because I like to run my one-shots with, like, I do them with the D&D system, but I try to make them a little more unique by giving each one of the characters a secret objective that they have got to work out. And so I prep with, like, you know, I make really interesting, I do a lot of Photoshopping, so I Photoshop all their letters and all the components for the game, and I have the maps already pre-made. So I do a lot of that work and make sure everything's balanced. So I do a lot of prep for that because it's just one thing, and I want to make it as efficient as possible to pack in as much gameplay as possible. But for my continuous stories, little to none.
So, Joe, what do you, because you're the opposite. Like, I know you actually do prep for your stuff. What do you do to prep your sessions?
Well, I should preface with, I am also probably the person that GMs least of mm-hmm. the four people in this cast here. Mm-hmm. I am a much stronger player, in my opinion, than I am GM by far. But I don't know if I'd say that.
I think you're a really good GM.
Well, thank you.
Yeah.
we'll edit that part out. But the first thing I like to do is have a schedule, right? I want to keep the game moving. And again, kind of riffing off the keeping the action and keeping the gameplay moving, especially for one shots. But I like to say, okay, I know something is going to happen. I have these three curveballs, and if nothing has happened by, you know, X o'clock, I'm going to throw this curveball in there. I think that starts to keep me honest about what I want.
Actual timelines, right? Like, that's something that I found interesting, is that you actually have a physical 1 minute, 15 minute, 30 minute, like, I need to do an action that stirs, like, action, right?
Yeah, well, and it's crazy. I didn't do that for a long time, and I listened to the Pen Acquisition Inc. from Penny Arcade guys, and I was stunned that they could get through three or four battles in a D&D game in, you know, an hour and a half. And I thought, well, that we could do one battle all night. And so I started just listening. The rules change when you're doing it for entertainment and not just hanging out with your friends. But I thought, I wonder if we could do that with our group. And it sure as I did it, man, we were able to move at a clip and get stuff done, because I knew, hey, at this point, these things are going to show up. The fight is going to start on time. And so, I don't want to railroad people, but I do really try to adhere to that clock, you know.
So what kind of event, like, give me an example of like what a clock might look like, or what you might have on a clock.
So in the first Deadlands game we ran, I knew you were going to go into town, and town was going to be something you could explore for 30 minutes. So 30 minutes you were going to have to explore the town, go into the bar, maybe meet some NPCs, that sort of thing. If you hadn't figured out that something was up in the town in 30 minutes, I was going to say, okay, hey, listen, somebody comes running in and they're concerned, right? Mm-hmm. And then they'll explain to you, hey, the there's somebody who's, you know, no one goes out at night. Hey, the lights are going out. People are all hiding in this inn at this tavern at 30 minutes in. And then if you haven't left the tavern to go investigate, 30 minutes in, something's going to happen. You're going to hear a scream in the street, you know, and I'm going to compel some of the characters to take action. Some of the people who might be concerned about somebody's well-being out there. Cause that's
true.
I also like to drive it based on the characters. Cause mm-hmm. again, as a person who much prefers to play, the characters are what matters to me, you know, giving your characters as Ryan said, give them the chance to be heroes, to be cinematic. So 30 minutes in, you're going to have to leave there. And then if you're wandering around or if you're hiding, no matter where you go, 30 minutes after that, the baddie is showing up, right? Or you're following something to where the baddie is, or they engage you in the street, or they break into the inn and start slaughtering innocents, you know?
Yeah.
And I can guarantee it keeps it that pace. Now, if all of a sudden we have this great moment where people are militarizing the townsfolk and barricading the inn, I'll let you finish that. I want to hear how that goes. I want to hear the dissent awesome. Between the people. Yeah, that's where that improv comes in. And I much rather have that context and then be surprised with cool improv and cool character ideas than be sitting there waiting for someone to do that and then have to make up something. It always just feels false to me. And I guess that's maybe my own hang up, but that's kind of how I prep a session and a campaign.
So I'm going to let, because I know Matt also does a little bit of writing too. I kind of want to jump into, because I don't do a lot. For me, prepping a session is more about the prep work I did for the campaign ahead of time. I spend a lot of my time prepping a campaign that can sort of give me the idea of what the next session is going to be, because that's one of my hardest. I'm not very creative in the sense of, I can long-term plan a story out. That's just not one of my strengths. But I am good at, well, I need to, because I've run games for so freaking long. If you tell me this is the game, right? We're going to do a classic, you know, highway robbers, or, you know, you've got to steal somebody from, you're now the high, like either against or you're the highway robbers, right? Or whatever tropey nonsense you got to run. If I know what it is, I can run it. It's just, for whatever reason, I have a big mental block against, you know, what the what of the happening, certainly ahead of time, because I don't like to write what the players are going to do. So I tend to try and make the playground for them to play in, so I can just sort of react to what they're doing the best I can, but not really direct them anywhere. Like, you know, this thing happened and you got to deal with it. But to actually prep sessions, I, for the most part, try and make sure I can give decent maps for people, and I can make up characters and whatnot, and I have at least a stable. If an NPC is important, I stat them out. But for the most part, I just need a stable of people I'm able to do, and that's about it. I really don't do a ton other than to ask the players what they want to do next session and then try and run that.
I think
Sorry, go ahead.
I think the fact that you just said asking your players is really important to note too, in that if you're GMing or you're working, or if you're even a player, I think that communication between the GM and the players as to what kind of game, like the session zero that we had talked about, Ricky.
Session zero, it's like, so big.
I
love session zero.
Just making characters.
I feel so good about session zero. If there's one thing.
Yeah.
Session zero, we collectively agree. So extra advice later, but we agree, if you take anything from this, if you're going to run a game, do a session zero. Go ahead and talk about session zero, Ryan.
Well, session zero is essentially, you don't really start the game necessarily. You build your characters and you get together with the group, and it's just deciding what sort of game you want to play. Like, okay, so let's say you don't know, you all want to RP, right? You all want to do tabletop, but you're not really sure on what it is you want to do, or maybe you do. Maybe let's just use Dungeons and Dragons as an example. Okay, if you're playing Dungeons and Dragons and you've said that, okay, first, what continent do you want to be on? What kind of world do you want to be? Do you guys have a specific module you want to run, or do you want this free for all? And then you can get more in the specifics, not just your character creation, but that's important. But how hard do you want it to be? Do you want there to be permadeath? Like, do you want me to be really difficult on, if I'm the GM, do you want me to really make you feel the consequences of your actions? Or do you guys want to be really awesome heroes? Are you looking just to be the best heroes and to go through and like that sort of thing? And then when you get to your individual player characters, like talking with them individually, ideally separate from the group, on what's your backstory? What are your hooks? Like, what's this character about? That helps you craft the world better. And makes the first session easier.
We're getting like way in the weeds here. My unpopular opinion is that I never want longer than about Twitter length backgrounds for characters. I want you to know the world you're playing in, understand the situation, and maybe send me a background after your, okay, so we'll use D&D as an example because it's like a universal language. I really don't want your character background until you're like level 3 or 4, right? So that way you know your character, because you don't know your character until you play them,
I think, right? that might be a preference thing, Ricky, because maybe it depends on your play. Yeah. I play with
I understand this is not for everybody.
It's not that it's unpopular, Ricky. For me, it's that I play with a lot. My primary demographic that I GM for, other than my one group I'm doing this Monster Hunter thing, are players that haven't played a lot of Dungeons and Dragons, a lot of newbies. And so it helps them role play if before the session they think of their backstory a little more.
Okay, I buy that. Yeah.
Well, and there's a great section on the old Vampire the Masquerade dungeon guide, Dungeon Master's Guide. I think the second edition one, they talked about the different types of problem players, and I'd never seen it written up anywhere else, but it's bad to say problem player because a lot of these things add a lot of good to it. And one of them is the person who wants to write their background, you know? And I think that's the where a lot of us start to have that writing bug and have that storytelling bug, but maybe don't have the confidence to run, is being able to bring this really interesting character to the table. And of course the problem is now you can't kill them. Now they're a certain importance to the story. It becomes their show, but it's something that I think is worth encouraging to some degree. I think I split the difference of it.
All right. So, how do you like your backstories though?
I think if I can know your character enough for somebody to be able to say, wow, that's a very whatever character thing to do, right? I played this character Hank for a long time with Ricky, and there are things that Hank would do that people would just go, oh, that's such a Hank thing to do. Oh, Hank's at it again, you know? And I think from his background, he was just kind of a good old boy. He was preacher's son, good old boy, soldier of fortune kind of guy. And that's all you needed to know. But I think there are other characters who can be more complex than that. That's like, again, harkening back to Fate, another plug. You can get that out of an aspect, which is why I think steering towards the Twitter length thing works. But I like to give people the chance to spread their wings.
Matt, how much of a backstory do you have? And we got a little off topic. What sort of prep do you do for your sessions?
Well, see, that really depends, kind of like Ryan said, on knowing your players. When I'll take the Star Wars campaign I ran, for example, my thing was starting out with the elevator pitch to each of the players. Hey, it's a year after Order 66. You're Force users. How do you fit into this universe? And then taking where everybody kind of approached that from, I said, all right, now I've got an idea in my head of how this is going to go. From that point, once you start knowing your players, knowing what they like, as an example, I learned a couple sessions in, Ricky hates puzzles.
I hate puzzles in games only because, okay, so I hate puzzles in real life, and unlike, okay, so here's the thing about puzzles in D&D. My character can't solve them. I have to, and I don't like puzzles. I don't like crossword puzzles. I don't like any of that stuff. I don't like actually putting puzzles together. I like...
That's absolutely fair. And the thing of it is, when if you have group like the five players in my Star Wars campaign all have rapidly varying levels of expertise with role-playing in general. One of them, for example, has been kicked out of literally five other games at the same store for being an unrepentant murder hobo. For some reason, he's well-behaved in my campaign. I don't know why. But knowing that going in, saying, okay, this is what the player likes. Let me find a way to enable that without it going off the rails. I know another player likes her huge written-out backstories that I say, okay, I'll find a way to tie this in, but not to where it takes over the session. And it's exactly like something Ricky has said a lot, and I fully agree with, that each player needs to know you are the main character in one story and a supporting character in five others. Be willing to share that spotlight. And that works as a GM as well. I kind of have an unofficial rule at the table. No one should talk for more than 90 seconds at a time, including the GM. For prep, it's know where your players are, know what they like, and I always enter a session with, this is where you started when last we left our intrepid heroes.
Yeah, because you've always got like a written blurb at the beginning of every episode of whatever you're running.
Of course, it's incredibly easy because Star Wars traditionally has the crawl.
Yeah.
And that's a great way to introduce an adventure. When last we left our intrepid heroes, or Ryan mentioned Avatar The Last Airbender, how The Legend of Korra always started with the Republic City newsreel.
That's
the greatest. The what has gone before is, especially if you've had players who've missed sessions, if you've had like 3 weeks between your last gaming session, bring that in there. And I always are like, okay, I want to hit scene A, scene B, scene C. Now, one way of going about it is your players are going to hit those no matter what. No matter which direction they go, this railroad is a hidden track. They're always going to be hitting these. That's a perfectly legitimate way to do it. What I like doing is, okay, I want them to hit A, B, and C, but if they pull a Ricky and go off sideways, then, like Ryan said, improv is such a great tool for that.
Pull a Ricky. I'm just gonna noting that one for later. Continue.
One of the great examples I had when I was running D&D is there was a the players were all snowed in at an inn, and a theft had happened. And one of the things that it was the culprit was a dwarf. He had been hiding and tried to fake his own death. So the players are looking around for clues and whatnot, and I roll randomly completely on, okay, they found something. They found a gem. And so they went, there's no way a dwarf would have left a gem behind. He has to be the victim. And in my mind, I suddenly went, that makes so much sense. I am altering the plot now. Because being willing to change your idea so where the players can actually follow along with something is a great skill. Something I've always hated in computer games were games like Myst or Riven, which I call find the pixel games. If you don't click on the exact right spot, you can't proceed. I hate that in gaming. It almost seems like of a GM who wants to be clever and
player
sometimes.
Yeah. And they're just like, you're not a good writer. You're me.
The one answer to my riddle or you can't continue is a terrible tactic.
I agree.
Yeah, for sure. Well, that's one of those things too, that the number of times you've been up against that or you can count because you remember them all as being really, really painful, you know?
And for prep work, one of the things I do, and Ryan mentioned Critical Role, and I actually learned this from Matt Mercer's GMing tips, is to have a list of just names and basic traits that an NPC can have. So the last Star Wars session I ran, the players had to contact a rebel spy on Morlius, and they decided they were going to chat up the receptionist. I had no idea who this receptionist was going to be, so I pick a random name and characteristic off this. They start engaging so much, I was like, oh hell, this receptionist is their contact. And going with that, so that all feeds off each other.
Yeah.
That's one of the advantages for me.
Yeah.
Yeah, but it's the prep as well is having that ready because when it's like, oh hey, what's this guard's name? And it's Hector.
Hey, that's always Steve.
Hey, that is one of the reasons why I, honest to God, always have random character name generator up on my computer every time I run, just in case I need to have someone's character name. And sometimes I will make a name based off anything that comes to my head, and I'll make it into a name. Like, for some reason, do you remember Stove A? Because he was playing on the stove, and I turned it into Stove A? Or someone said Steve. Or no, it may have been his name was Steve. And like, no, Steve's a dumb Star Wars name. He's Stove A, right? And whatever.
We run with that.
I had a character sheet get misprinted on a page that printed out a Google page on the other side, so I named him Goog. One of my favorite characters ever.
All right, so I want to jump into you kind of talking about advice, and I want to give each of us an opportunity to just give some free advice that if you had to pass one thing, if you wanted to get into RPGs, this is absolutely my advice when you play them or run them or whatever you guys want to do. And then we'll kind of wrap this up after that. So I don't know who – let's go ahead and – Matt, I gave you were kind of jumping into it, so I'll give you the opportunity to round up another one. Joe, if you had to give someone advice for role-playing games, playing or running, what would it be?
I would say pay attention to who's sitting around the table with you. I had a real bad history of everything being the Joe show, as I call it, which is, again, in that book of a problem type of character being the star. And that was really my big issue, and I really got a lot more out of the game when I started looking around the table and saying, oh man, so-and-so hasn't said anything. Maybe they're shy. Maybe they don't know the game all that well. Like, I'm going to be friends with them. I'm gonna bring them in, and I know I can run an entertaining 5 minutes for at least myself, so let's get somebody else the spotlight. So I think even as a GM or as a player, being able to look around the table and say, oh, you know what, I see they're not necessarily into this. Let's grab them and put them in the front. And then, you know, it has the chance to backfire. But a lot of times people really appreciate that, especially because they now have a wingman. The GM is making it about them, is making it fun. Or the players, like, I got your back. Let's do this.
Call that playing the Watson. It's the role of Dr. Watson in all the Sherlock Holmes stories. Yeah. He's there to enable Holmes's stuff. Be willing to be Dr. Watson.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. I don't know. Let's Ryan, if you had to give, you know, advice for someone who wanted to play RPGs or just RPG advice in general, either running or playing, what would it be?
My biggest advice to anyone is to don't be afraid to speak. Don't be afraid that you're going to say something stupid. Don't be afraid to RP something out. Like, I know there's a lot of social anxiety when it comes to being around people, especially, you know, even if you're with your friends. No, you're at the end of the day, you're all playing a tabletop game. Like, it's I think that a lot of newer players especially don't want to feel like they're trying to wrestle control or something like that. I think that, and a lot of new DMs as well, like, I can sometimes go off the rails by not being confident in the things that they're trying to set up or the things that they do. You know, they do something and their players hem and haw a little bit and suddenly they back down. Have confidence in the things that you're doing, and if you really believe it, your players will buy in and they'll work with it. And if you're a player character, your DM, if they're any good, will buy into your confidence in the things that you're doing.
Yeah, it's great. That's great advice.
So I'll tell you, mine would be certainly for Dungeon Masters. I think the one thing I could tell you is if you want to know what the most, like the best GM advice per page, you know, the most useful, usable GM advice per page of any book I've ever read was the Dungeon Master's Guide in Dungeon World, the RPG. You know, it's based off of the Apocalypse World system. And they have a method for how they say stuff like, you know, principles for GMing, you know, moves you can make as a GM, how you can create, you know, fronts to like deal and do things to your players, to where you don't have to actually work very hard to be a very, very interesting dungeon master. Also moves you can steal. It's just, there's so much stuff there. Like if you want to run a game, for the love of God, go check out that book and read it, because it's absolutely changed who I was as a GM. Also, the one thing that you should take from there is to always be a fan of your players no matter what you do.
Yeah.
When you're running a game, is that you are there to see them be to see them go through a really, really cool story.
Yeah, the old it's not you versus the players, it's everyone making a story.
Yeah. I want to try and like your character as much as I can and put him in situations that are as interesting as possible. That's only because I like that character. And I think that's something to start from. And then it basically starts off with that and gets into a whole bunch of useful GM stuff. So, I mean, stealing the moves alone, you could run games off of that. Yeah. Just like literally, you know, separate them, you know, like that's like, you don't know what to do right now. So you pull off the little chart and says, separate them. Cool. Done. You guys, a rock gets in your way and, you know, the monsters are attacking you. I don't care. Right. So like that sort of thing is useful. Anyway, so that's definitely my Dungeon World. For the love of God, go read it.
It's the gateway drug to Fate.
But the GM section I use for every game. Anyways, Matt, since I gave you some time, what are some advice for people playing RPGs, running or playing, would you give?
I am always trying to push, especially on newer players, don't be afraid to fail. RPGs are not like competitive games. For example, let's use X-Wing as an example. If you land on your rock and all your green dice come up blanks, that there's no way to spin that into a positive. You've just had a shitty time. But if you are playing an RPG and your character is running and trying to, you know, jump over the gorge, and that natural one comes up, that doesn't mean you made a bad choice. That means you now get to fear. It's another step in the story that you're telling. You know, the Star Wars and especially the FFG system allows for the idea of success with threat or failure with advantage, where you can turn an obvious negative into something good. The dice do not determine how well you've played. That's one of those things where I wish I could just get newer players to realize your character screwing up doesn't mean you did something bad. And some of the best role-playing moments I've ever seen come out
due to failure.
Yes. You know, the apocryphal story that's making the rounds about the fighter tries to intimidate the orc, rolls a natural one. The orc tries to intimidate him back, rolls a natural one. Long story short, now they're married.
So good. Yep. So good.
That's an exaggeration, but that's how the things can come out there. And those end up turning out to be the best stories. Sure, everybody loves the story about how you lunge forward and slice the ogre's head off with one blow, but people love the story more of that time when Sunrise sat on his own rifle and shot himself in the ass.
All right, so...
with the failure.
All right, so Ryan had a good idea how to end this up, and I'm going to add to it just because I'm just curious. We're going to wrap this up. I'm going to give everybody a minute to tell me your favorite system and a favorite moment in an RPG game. And since it was your idea, Ryan, I'm going to let you go first.
My favorite system has got to be, I've played not a ton, admittedly, but I've played enough, and I still think my favorite is the one that that D is creating right now. I can't hype it enough. Someday he'll eventually get it written up and maybe launch a Kickstarter or do something, try to get it published.
I'm just saying that I heard just now that you're going to get us playtests. Documents or whatever, so we can
playtest this for you. Yeah, he's still working on getting it together so that he can outsource playtesting to a few outside groups. Hey, but
I heard it. Cool.
I heard it. Yeah. The VIP.
As soon as he does, I will try and convince him to get you guys those documents. But it's the customization and the flexibility and makes it amazing. But that someday.
What's a favorite moment of yours? Yeah, in RPG.
And my all-time favorite moment in RPing is when I was actually playing as a character, and it was our first session of a new campaign, and I was trying to pillage from a battlefield a sword because my character wanted to be a swordsman. Oh, we all started out as peasants. We're pitiful peasants, and there were monks there cleaning the battlefield. And in D's lore for this system, there are monks, and then there are these guys called fighting monks. And basically, picture a fighting monk is essentially like a Dragon Ball Z Saiyan. They're so powerful, but they're a force for good. Well, this monk caught us trying to pillage supplies from the battlefield, and D just randomly rolled to see if he happened to be a fighting monk. But they're so rare, he would have to roll like a critical failure for that to be a monk. Well, he rolled a 4, and it turned out that was a fighting monk, and he found that out because one of my characters tried to just knock out this weak monk, and the character failed, and so suddenly it's this fighting monk, and then I went to protect my friend. I'm like, I'm just gonna attack this guy, and we figured we'd all die and we'd have to re-roll characters and start a new campaign. I rolled a 23 to attack the character, and basically that meant that I just chopped his head off and killed him. And killed the fighting monk. And so the entire game from that point forward spiraled out of control because my character killed it'd basically be like me walking up to a fireman and shooting him in the face. Everyone loves fighting monks. And I just killed one. And so like the church's inquisition was after me, and it spiraled. The entire campaign was all built on this first session of D accidentally creating a fighting monk from this normal monk and me accidentally killing him. It's just out of this. That was a little long-winded, but that's my all-time favorite.
No, absolutely. I love that. All right, so Matt, what is your favorite system, and give me your favorite moment in any RPG you played in Nerve.
All right, I would say my favorite system has to be the open source D20 system that Wizards of the Coast did when they took over D&D. That was 3rd edition, 3.5, Pathfinder, and somewhat a 4th edition. The idea of one die roll common for any task was great, and it can be adapted to anything.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, totally.
I just love that concept. As for a favorite moment, I've got so many, but the one that first comes to mind was a game of Mage of the Awakening, so old school. Our players had almost like your casting call of characters. You had the weird Son of Ether. You had the dime store Akashic Brotherhood monk type. I was playing Troy Metzger, Euthanatos Death Mage, and starting cornerback for the University of Michigan. Troy's whole thing was that I was going to play against type to every single World of Darkness trope by playing a character who had no ranks in the occult.
Oh my gosh.
Who knew absolutely nothing outside of, hey, I do community service working in an old folks home, and when these old people die, I feel great. So everything that happened in that game, Troy reacted to it in the way that your average, college football guy would. The storyteller was throwing these things out. You have discovered the existence of a cabal of nefandic vampires. Troy, nefandic vampires? Holy shit! Yeah, it was great. And he interrupts the Tremere's great speech by just tackling him out a window, because that's what you do when someone soliloquizes. And the idea of playing somebody who is so not just against type, but against the type of the setting was wonderful. And it led to one of the greatest quotes of all time when we had played, one of our roommates had only played D&D before. And the greatest thing I've ever heard a storyteller say was, "There's no looting the bodies in Mage. And what's more important, there's no looting the bodies in Denny's." That's just become the greatest non sequitur for gaming.
Beautiful.
I would say my favorite RPG system, it's either Fate or FFG Star Wars. I like FFG Star Wars a lot because I like crunchy games, but I don't like games that are so crunchy that not everybody can pick it up quick, fast enough. Like, I think D&D is hard to pick up to be like truly tactically good at D&D, and I like tactics. I mean, for me to play is probably fourth edition. For me to run is probably like Fate or FFG Star Wars. My favorite moment, this is going to sound funny, but it's not actually exciting or anything. So I'm sorry about this, for this excellent content, but I ran a game based off of the TV show Deadwood, sort of like the what would Deadwood in Eberron look like? Eberron's a D&D setting, right? Is everybody familiar with Eberron? If you're not,
yeah,
it's like the greatest D&D setting ever, right? So, so basically, it was there was this Talenta Plains, natives like that had this Kyber's rush. The Kyber shards are, dragon shard rush, and it was right on the border with the Morholds and Karnath, and Karnak's trying to annex it and all this stuff. And so all of this political stuff is happening in sort of an Old West style D&D game, and then sprinkle in a healthy amount of D&D fights with goblins, orcs, and whatever bad guys would feel like making, right? And the story was, we were going to, it was coming to the point where Karnath wanted to annex the town, right? They were coming, they were offering money, they were making a deal with the Talentans to annex that land, and the players and the townspeople met together to discuss what they were going to do as a town to either, incorporate into Karnath, what have you, like what their plan was going to be to not lose all of this land they had effectively built and, built businesses and stuff on. And the discussion, like, between the players was really, really interesting on what they wanted to do. And I know this is super boring. This is not even like my style of game. My style of games are like, I want to try and pace as much as possible. I want you fighting. I want you doing stuff. But for whatever reason, they were all bought in because they all had owned businesses in this town. And I don't know, something about that session was really, really fun, because there was a lot of, trying to get votes and stuff. And
it's really interesting.
It was a really, really cool session. And I loved that campaign. And that was probably my favorite of that campaign. Joe ended up playing that campaign later. That's where his Hank character was, but I don't think you made that session though, Joe.
I did not make that session. When you mentioned the Plains Halflings, I thought you were going to a very different story, which was one of my favorites. It's not the one I'm going to say here, but
are you talking about when you realized Drunk Steve was your brother?
Well, no, I was gonna. Well, that was a great moment too. I was gonna say when I added a Hydra with a pterodactyl.
So this session had sessions like this game had sessions like that, and also dinosaurs attack the town. So it was a little column A, column B, kind of whatever I was feeling that day. So, anyways, that session was super interesting in like the politics behind it, and I don't think I've ever run politics as well as like that one session. That was partially because I had another GM who could play NPCs and we could text each other. So if players could go off and negotiate with this guy for a vote or that guy for a vote, and like you could kind of split everybody off a little bit. And that was before I was kind of doing everything in front of people. I don't know. It was really, really good. Anyway, so I'm probably not too far into that. Joe, What's your favorite system, and what's your favorite RPG moment?
Well, my favorite system is Fate, for sure. Mm-hmm. I just find it as a person whose characters always have system-based limitations. It's so cool to say, hey, we're going to play some Shadowruns, and my guy has robot arms. Cool, I have an aspect, he has robot arms. Now I can do all of the stuff, and I don't have to worry about the rules or anything like that.
Yeah, anything that involves robot arms, just spin a fate chip, and I did that.
Yeah, yep, and I think that's just so empowering. And it's poison to new players, and so I get why it isn't for everybody, but when you get the hang of it and you really have a strong sense of character, I just think there's no beating it. Mm-hmm. And my favorite RPG moment, I am really torn. One is less public appropriate, so I'll give it an honorable mention of successfully having consensual relationships with a player who was of the opposite gender in game. Oh, she was a drow. and it was consensual. Everything was great. We romanced each other in character, in game.
Okay. So to your credit, like I ran this. It was all above board, and it was actually pretty, like if it was a TV show, it would be entertaining, right? So yeah. You had completely, like, only if, like, if it were a movie, it'd be completely tasteful, I'll say.
Yes. So, but that's honorable mention. The real great one of players all working together was I played a game of Scion, so it's another White Wolf moment here. Played in a game of Scion, which is, like, if you've ever played Vampire or anything, the dice dots.
Scion to me is American Gods is the RPG.
Yeah, and it's if your dots didn't stop at five. So everybody has ridiculous stats, and they work for a god, and they're all super overpowered. And we had to protect some magical artifact that was an egg, and it was in some Las Vegas penthouse somewhere. And this god just told us, "Hey, you got to guard this egg, and you're not allowed to move it. These guys are going to come take it tomorrow night. You have till then to get set up and protect it." And so everybody, our Black Ops guy goes and requisitions a bunch of military gear. We had another dude who was laying traps and tripwires and bribing the employees to keep us informed of what was going on and tapping into surveillance around the hotel. And I was playing a movie star because I thought, well, what's the most OP thing you can be? And that's an action movie star. And so I said, well, hold on. I went to the librarian for my god, or the person with the highest occult roll I could find. And I said, "Hey, man, do you know anything about this egg?" And the guy rolled 14 or 18 successes or something stupid. And he says, "No, I don't know anything about it. I don't even know what it looks like." I said, "Okay, cool. If he doesn't know, there's no way the guy's coming to take it." No. So I went out and I bought a Fabergé egg, a tablecloth, and a nice glass case. And when we finally got into the room, we weren't allowed to get in the penthouse until like an hour before they attacked. Because it would give it away if there were random people in there. So we sneak in an hour before, and I walk in, and there's this egg sitting on a little tray, this like ornate-looking egg sitting on a tray on the middle of a table. And I just put the case on top of that, threw the tablecloth over it, and set the egg on top. And these guys jump in, and everybody's shooting and going crazy. And then I yell out with my incredible 9 dot acting, "Oh no, he's going for the egg!" And this guy dives and grabs the egg off the top, and they all retreat out of there and bail. I was like, "All right, guys. Call it a day."
Savage.
Yeah. The GM was like, "You're right. I just gave you the role because I had the GM roll in front of me. It's like, tell me good. This guy doesn't know anything about it." Dig your own grave.
Right.
All right. So I think we are well over the hour that we were going to do. So I think we should go ahead and wrap up here. Guys, I really do appreciate you guys coming on. This is fun.
It was a blast. Thanks for having us.
Yeah, thanks, we'll man. Love it.
We'll see what we come up next, Captain's Quarters, whenever I get hair up my ass. Maybe we'll do like the NBA. I don't know. And I'll go. I don't know, man. It's whatever I feel like, right?
Yo, we need to do a fantasy football cast. That's what we got to do.
Oh, my. Dude, I'm okay. So I'm low key trying to avoid the NFL, but I really like fantasy sports, and Patrick Mahomes is going to be Patrick Mahomes.
Mahomes!
Oh my God, Matt! I'm not.
There's a fate system for you.
There it is.
All right. So I'm doing my best, but we'll see how much willpower I have. Anyways, I guess hold up, if I can do this, I got to get my radio voice back on. This has been the Captain's Quarters. Thank you for your RPG session. Now listen to the smooth jazz of, you know, the Cantina Band or some music.